כי שיצא למלחמה על אויביך, ומשנאו אדוני אלוהיך בידיך, ושביסה שביו. When you will go out to war against your enemies, and Hashem your God will deliver them into your hand, and you will capture its captivity. OU Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Ki Teitse. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 12th day of Elul, 5775, and corresponding to the 27th day of August. 12 Elul, August 27. Ki Teitse, big sedra, not necessarily in size, but in number of mitzvot, number one on the all-time mitzvah list, with 74 mitzvot, subdivided into 44 parshiot. That's another record it holds. And the number of psukim is a modest, almost there, 110. 110 is just about as average as you could get it in the Torah. I think the average is closer to 108.6, but this is your most average sedra in length. But as I said, number one in parshiot and number one in mitzvot. And we'll talk about some of those mitzvot and the concepts that stand behind them. First, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Excuse me. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihyena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmorya Adonai mi'amod ki imacha haslicha l'ma'an tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya. Ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yorachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha u'me'afela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar amen. Apropos the music that opened the show, it was the song, or at least the sounds, of a dove or a pigeon. I don't know specifically which kind, but I am familiar with that sound. I hear it very often in the morning in my on my mirpeset outside my living room window and door. And it's there to start the show because of one of the many, many mitzvot in the Sedra, actually two of them, deal with what is known as Shiluach HaKen. The psukim themselves say the following in English. If a bird's nest happens to be before you on the road, or any tree or on the ground, young birds or eggs, the mother is roosting on the young birds or the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. That is a prohibition in the Torah, one of the 639 lo ta'ases, lavin of the Torah. And it continues, you shall surely send away the mother bird and take the young for yourself, so that it will be good for you and will prolong your days. Shiluach HaKohen is a kind of strange mitzvah that defies simple explanation and common sense. Picture the following. You're on a walk through the woods, and you glance down on the ground or up in a tree, and you happen to see a bird's nest. And the bird's nest has eggs or newly hatched chicks, hatchlings, I guess they're called. And the mother bird is hovering around the nest, hanging out there. If the bird is kosher and it does not belong to you, which would fit with the description I gave of happening upon it, which is the way the Torah says, ki yikare kan sipor lifanecha, baderech bechol eitz o al haaretz, then there are two mitzvot that kick in. One is a prohibition, and that means if for some reason you want that mother bird, let's say it was a dove, or a quail, the kosher kind, or a sparrow. For whatever reason you would want that mother bird, you're not allowed to take it. It's a prohibition in the Torah to take the mother bird away from the nest. It is a prohibition to take away the mother bird with the nest. The only thing you have is the second mitzvah that kicks in, and that is, if you want the eggs or the hatchlings, you must chase away the mother bird, and if it comes back, you chase it away again until it's not near the nest, and then you're allowed, with Torah permission, to take the eggs or the hatchlings. Remember, if it's not a kosher bird, this mitzvah does not apply. The interesting question, which I don't have a complete answer for, is if the mitzvah doesn't apply, then what does that mean? In other words, if I happen upon a woodpecker's nest. A woodpecker, I am pretty sure, belongs to a class of birds that are not kosher. Let's be a little bit more sure. A crow or a raven. I happen upon a raven's nest, very common bird here in Yerushalayim, the hooded crow, in Hebrew known as the gray raven. And you happen upon that nest, there is no mitzvah in the Torah that kicks in. So the question then is, what would I be allowed to do? Can I take the mother bird if I want to? Well, there is no prohibition of taking the mother bird, but the question now is, what effect does that have on the mother bird and on the chicks? Because there is another category of mitzvah, no less significant than Shiluach HaKohen, called Tsa'ar Balei Chaim, cruelty to animals. So it might be that you're not allowed to touch it at all. Or it might be that if you take the nest with the mother bird in such a way that does not cause her distress, since it's a non-kosher bird and you wouldn't be violating, then you could do that. I don't know. The point that I'm trying to make by using that illustration is that we're dealing with a kind of enigmatic mitzvah. Because if you think about it, the Torah might have said, if you happen upon a bird's nest and there are eggs or hatchlings and a mother bird is right there, walk on, don't take it. But that's not what the Torah says. In fact, there is a dispute among scholars, Kabbalists on one side and let's call them Talmudists on the other side, where the Kabbalists say it would be a requirement to fulfill this mitzvah if you happen upon a bird's nest, where the conditions make the mitzvah apply. And that includes even if you don't want the eggs or the hatchlings, you have to do it. Because the Torah says, Shaleach tishalach et ha'em, ve'et ha'banim tikach lach. The Talmudists will say, argue that if you happen upon that nest, and if you want the eggs or the chicks, then the only recourse that you have is to fulfill the mitzvah of chasing away the mother bird and then taking the eggs. If you want the mother bird, too bad, because she is hovering over a nest with eggs or chicks, and the Torah forbids lo tikach ha'em al habanim. Let me just further complicate the issue. There is a Mishnah, which I think occurs twice in Shisha Sidre Mishnah, that says, one of the times is in Brachot, that says if a person prays to God, God, please have mercy on your children, like you show to the mother bird in the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen, mashtikin oto. We tell the person to be quiet, because this mitzvah defies being defined as something that is kind. It is possible that it's the opposite of kindness. It is possible that it has nothing to do with kindness or not. But it is a mitzvah which we can't fully understand, and therefore we cannot use it in the illustration of have mercy just like. Now, to move on to other mitzvot, but the same idea. There are mitzvot in Parshat Ki Teitzeh and elsewhere which seem to be clear that it is an act of kindness to fulfill that mitzvah. For example, Lo tachsom shor bedisho. Do not muzzle an ox when it is working with food, when it is on the threshing floor. So in the olden times, before threshing machines, you had wheat that was brought in after the harvest to a room of some sort, a circular room perhaps, and in the middle was a tether to which an ox was harnessed. And as the ox walked around in a circle, he would crunch open the husks of the wheat kernels, and further processing of the threshed wheat by winnowing and by separating would extract the kernels from their husks. And in that process, you're not allowed to muzzle the ox, because if it gets the munchies, it has to be able to bow down, put its head down, I mean, and munch. And to restrict it by muzzling it is not a nice thing to do. Now, wait a minute. The Torah does not say that. The Torah says, Lo tachsom shor bedisho. Do not muzzle an ox on the threshing floor. Chazal, our sages, explained with a high degree of certainty and confidence that they figured this particular mitzvah out, that it was or would be an act of cruelty to not allow it to eat, and therefore the mitzvah became one of the foundations of the concept of kindness to animals. I think you could almost say that our sages hardly hesitated to use that mitzvah. And yet, when it came to Shiluach HaKen, there are details which make it too complex to attempt to use it as an example of kindness or anything else. Specifically, the fact that it applies to a kosher bird and not to a non-kosher bird, because those things that are related to tsa'ar balei chayim, cruelty to animals, apply to kosher and to non-kosher animals equally. Because we're not allowed to be cruel to a kosher animal, and you're not allowed to be cruel to a non-kosher animal. So that already is a tip-off. And the fact that it has to be in nature, in the wild, not owned with Shiluach HaKen. In other words, if you have doves in your dovecote or wherever you keep them, and they have a nest and the mother is over the nest, you could take the mother bird from the nest. Or you could take them together, because it's not ki korei kan sipor lefanecha. And those kind of things sort of throw a monkey wrench into explaining the mitzvah as a basis of tsar balei chayim. Now we get a little bit more complicated. There is another mitzvah in the Sedra. Lo tacharosh b'shor uvechamor yachdav. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You cannot harness an ox and a donkey together to pull a plow or to do any other task. Or it doesn't even have to be an ox and a donkey. It could be any two non-compatible animals. So you have, for example, in Dr. Seuss's first book from 1937, and to think that it happened on Mulberry Street, you have a picture in the book which caught my eye the first time I saw it, and I guess every time since, of an elephant harnessed to two giraffes pulling a bandwagon, which is pulling a trailer with an old guy sitting in a rocking chair so that there would be somebody always to be able to listen to the band. And that is a pure example of a prohibition on a Torah level, because we are taught by the oral law that Charisha lav dafka, Shor lav dafka, and Chamor lav dafka, meaning lo tacharosh, do not plow, not necessarily just plowing, anything is included. Bishor uvechamor, with an ox and a donkey, not just them, but any two non-compatible animals, yachdav, together. So there, many of our mitzvah explainers in the past have said, here's another example of a mitzvah that prohibits that which would be an act of cruelty. You harness a donkey with an ox or a giraffe with an elephant, and you're dealing with a heavy, slow-moving animal and a friskier, smaller animal, lighter animal, and they will pull at each other to their discomfort. That would be fine, and it is used, among other mitzvot, as one of those that belong to the category of tsar balei chayim, cruelty to animal, or avoiding cruelty to animal. But then you have the Rambam, whose opinion says the mitzvah from the Torah level of lo tacharosh b'shor v'chomor yachdav applies when one animal is kosher, like an ox, and one animal is not kosher, like a donkey. Which is why the Dr. Seuss example is perfect, because a giraffe is kosher and an elephant is not, which means that picture would be a Torah violation, even according to the Rambam. But what's problematic in the Rambam is that two kosher animals, even incompatible, like an ox and a giraffe, or two non-kosher animals, like an elephant and an armadillo, would not be a violation on a Torah level of lo tacharosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav, would only be forbidden by rabbinic law because of tsar balei chayim, cruelty to animals, and it then makes the Rambam's presentation of the mitzvah from the Torah, a little challenging because the kindness feature shouldn't make a distinction as to whether one animal is kosher and the other is not. The Rambam says, since the Torah used the example of shor v'chamor, it was purposely pointing us to a kosher animal and a non-kosher animal in this context. And you look into the Rambam and those of his ilk, and you find that they consider this prohibition not necessarily an issue of kindness to the animal, but a preventative measure to avoid crossbreeding of animals, which is very problematic according to the Rambam, because I don't think that an ox and a donkey can crossbreed. And I'll have to leave that open because I don't know how we get out of that problem. But I would say majority of our sources indicate that it is an issue of kindness to animals to avoid plowing or any other function with them together. And then it adds to lo tachsom shor b'disho, not to muzzle an animal when it's working with food, and it becomes another basis for a foundation stone of the rabbinic literature that's out there on the topic of kindness to animals and avoidance of tsar bali chayim, cruelty to animals. Remember, please, that part of the problem here is that the Torah rarely gives reasons for mitzvot. So if the Torah says you can't muzzle an animal when it's working with food, human beings are the ones that perceived that he must mean to avoid cruelty to the animal. But it's not stated in the written word, and I don't know if it is considered to be part of the oral law that is passed down. On that note, we will focus on a few examples of written word and oral law and their total inseparability when we come back with the second part of Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Ki Teitse. And if you think I'm speaking softly, slowly on purpose, the answer is yes, I am. We'll be right back. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Ki Teitse. Something that I've seen right in front of my face all these years, and it really just hit me. Ki teitze la milchama aloyavecha, when you go out to war against your enemies. That's how the Seder begins. It ends with Parshat Zachor. Zachor et asher eshalcha Amalek, remember what Amalek did, the mitzvah of going out to battle to defeat and wipe out Amalek, and not to forget them. So it begins with that, it ends with that. There's more stuff in the middle with war, hence the beginning of the second half of the show with the American Army Bugle Corps bugle call for charge going into battle. Okay, if you're listening to these two halves of the show sort of continuously, you won't feel the fact that I've had a big delay between the first half and the second half, but I have. So I have to really get back into the mode. I'm sitting here at my desk at the Israel Center, and on my wall is a garden shovel, a small garden spade shovel, which I bought years ago when I was in the Army in order to include it among the weapons that I carried in fulfillment of a mitzvah in the Torah. The Torah speaks about ki teitze machane al oyevecha, excuse me, when a camp goes out against your enemy, v'nishmarta mikol davar ra, you have to avoid all kind of bad things. Among them, the Torah says, v'yad tihiye lecha michutz l'machane, you have to set up a latrine outside the camp and do your call to nature there. V'yateid tihiye al alecha, al ezanecha, you shall have a shovel in addition to your weapons, And it will be that when you go sit outside, you shall dig with it, you shall go back and cover your excrement. Not the kind of thing that you would expect to find in the holy words of the Torah, but that's the Torah, and that's Judaism. It even goes to that extent. I have a very fond memory. I haven't been in the Army for the last 20-plus years, but when I was doing Miluim, all of my Miluim almost were done in an Army camp setting out in the desert or in the wilderness, not at any base, and I actually had to put that shovel to use. One time, I was coming back to our tent with the shovel, having been used to dig a hole and cleaned it up, and I come back, and I'm putting it in the bottom of my kit bag. That's the, that's what we call it, a kit bag, big knapsack. And in order to put it on the bottom in the plastic bag that I kept it in, I had to pull out my tallis and tefillin. And I'm holding my tallis and tefillin in one hand and a garden shovel in the other. And there was one of my colleagues sitting nearby, not a religious fellow. And I turned to him and I said in Hebrew, "With these I perform mitzvot," pointing to my tallis and tefillin. "And with this, I also fulfill a mitzvah." And he gave me this incredulous look, and he said, "What the hell are you talking about? Pardon my language." So I explained it to him, and I pulled out a book that I had with me, a sefer, called Dinei Tzava Umilchama, The Laws of the Army and War. And I showed him the chapter on V'haya Machanecha Kadosh, that your camp, your military camp, should be holy. And I gave it to him to read. That's an advantage. Even non-religious people in Israel know how to read Hebrew. He read it and handed it back to me and thanked me. That was it. 6 months later, we're on Miluim again at another field exercise. And he calls me over to the side and he says, "I want you to know that since you gave me that article to read, I started getting interested in a Parshat HaShavua class at my place of work, which I never ever thought would speak to me, but because of that chapter you showed me in that sefer, I started going to this class." That was it. 6 months later, pulls me off to the side again and says, "You might be interested to know that I started making kiddush on Friday nights. Never did it before. Not chas v'chalila, God forbid, because I'm becoming religious." He had to say that. "But because I want my children to see it." And I think his wife started lighting candles for the same reason. It would be nice if I had more to the story, but the two of us were the same age, and we were retired out of Miluim at the same time, and lost total touch with him. I'm embarrassed to say that I can't even remember his name. First name might have been Mark, but I'm not sure. And I certainly lived in Haifa, I think, and I'd have to go through a lot to find out where to contact him. But that's what happens in the Army, and that's what this shovel on my wall reminded me of, and it fit into the Sedra, so I told you the story. So now let's go to another topic that manifests itself in several of these mitzvot. Many of the mitzvot of Ki Teitse. There is a topic, I'm pretty sure I've spoken about it before, known as Yibum, levirate marriage in Hebrew, in English, sorry. The Torah says, Ki yeshavu achim yachdav. English, when brothers dwell together, and one of them dies, and he has, I have to read the Hebrew, uvein ein lo, he has no ben, lo tihyeh eshet hamet hachutza l'ish zar, his widow may not marry anyone else, except yivamah yavo oleha ulekacha lo l'isha v'yibmah. Her yavam is her dead husband's brother, shall take her as a wife and perform the mitzvah of yibum. The Torah continues, it shall be that the firstborn, if she can bear, shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, so that his name not be blotted out from Israel. But then it continues, if a man will not wish to marry his sister-in-law, then his sister-in-law shall ascend to the gate, to the elders, and she shall say, remind you of a tongue twister, she shall say, my brother-in-law refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He did not consent to perform yibum, levirate marriage, with me. Then the elders of the city shall summon him and speak to him, and he shall stand and say, I do not wish to marry her, which is his right. Then his sister-in-law shall approach him before the eyes of the elders. She shall remove his shoe from on his foot and spit before him, and shall speak up and say, so is done to the man who will not build the house of his brother. Then his name shall be proclaimed in Israel, the house of the one whose shoe was removed. Okay. What we're dealing in here with, and this is only background because of the point I want to get to, is that a man's brother and wife are forbidden to each other forever. During his lifetime, after his lifetime, still married, divorced, whatever. A brother-in-law, sister-in-law in that particular orientation, in other words, a man's brother's wife is forbidden to him. It's an incestuous relationship, punishable by death, with the notable exception of yibum. If a man dies without a ben, and I am purposely avoiding translating that word, then there is a relationship established between his widow and his brother that is called zikuk liyibum, potential to yibum, which is either consummated as a marriage or severed with a divorce-like process known as chalitza. Side point, but not a side point, in our day, our sages have banned yibum for over 1,000 years now because of the problems in society of a man taking a second wife if he has a first wife, or possible wrong motives of the brother and the widow, and it just doesn't fit with society's marital structure, we'll call it, and therefore Chazal, our sages, have banned it. They're allowed to do that because there is an alternative known as chalitza. The interesting thing, the important thing to keep in mind, is that chalitza, when yibum was available, was considered a disgrace. You do not want to uphold your brother's name in Israel by bearing a child from his wife that will follow in his name, and they'll say, that's the child of so-and-so. Disgrace. and the ceremony involved spitting in front of him. So there was a preference to Yibum and an alternative not preferred called Chalitza, but the option was there. In our time, where Yibum is banned by rabbinic law, there is only Chalitza, and therefore it is not a disgrace, and it is not something that a person should feel insulted by. It is the proper thing to do to release your brother's widow to be able to marry anyone else. Otherwise, she is locked into a situation, Aguna style. But that's not yet the point. The point is, the Torah says, when brothers live together, umet achat mehem, and one of them dies, uvein ein lo. What's a ben? A ben could be a son. A ben could be a child. And it makes a big, big difference here. Because if a man dies and is survived by a daughter, then the question is, what's the relationship, if anything, between the man's widow and his brother? If we say that ben means a son, a male child, and he died without a male child, and we say, therefore, there is this relationship established between the Avam and the Avama, then we would be permitting an incestuous relationship if the word ben is inclusive and not exclusive. Inclusive means a child, and sure enough, the Art Scroll Stone Edition Chumash translates, which is why I purposely didn't read the English anymore, when brothers live together and one of them dies and he has no child, then the wife of the deceased shall not marry outside to a strange man, her brother-in-law shall come, etc., etc. So the fact is that when the Torah says, Uvein ein lo, it means he has no offspring at all. And even though Yibum has been banned, Chalitza is still performed today. It is not a disgrace to the brother, and a brother should always cooperate with this system because it's a mitzvah and because he is not going to torture the woman who will be then restricted from marrying anyone else. But the point that I was driving at was that the word ben is inclusive of sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters, offspring. There are other contexts in the Torah where ben means son, as opposed to daughter. There are times in the Torah where the word yom means a full 24-hour day, as in Zachor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho, which is Kiddush on Friday night and Havdalah on Motzoi Shabbat. There are times where the word Yom means daytime as opposed to nighttime. Inclusive, exclusive. Uvayom HaShemini Yimol B'sar Orlato, on the eighth day you shall circumcise the boy. From there we are taught that circumcision may not be performed at night. Ulekachtem lachem bayom harishon, take the arba minim, lulav etrog hadasim aravot, on the first day, daytime, not nighttime. We go into the sukkah at the eve of the first day of Sukkot, even though the Torah says, shivat yamim, 7 days you shall dwell in the sukkah, but we are taught that ulekachtem lachem bayom harishon means daytime and not nighttime. The word chamor, we've already mentioned, means donkey as a representative of any animal. And an ox is an ox or any animal working with food. But we find contexts where chamor, for donkey, means only chamor, a firstborn male offspring of a female donkey, called in Hebrew an aton, called in English a jenny. That firstborn, if it's male, must be redeemed in a process called pidyon peter chamor, and it applies only to a donkey. You have a firstborn horse, a firstborn dog, a firstborn elephant, lion, I don't care what. There is no pidyon required or done. Only a donkey. So we're having a situation where the Torah uses a term and it means it exclusively. It uses the same term someplace else and it means inclusively. How are we supposed to know? That's the point. And the answer is Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. The written word is open to misinterpretation, to distortion. Just picture that first situation I described of Yibum. The elders of a village in ancient Israel get together and they're not that knowledgeable, and they have a Torah scroll and they know how to read the Torah. And the way the Torah reads in writing, we're talking about a child to be born to brother and widow, who will follow and be named for the deceased brother and keep his name alive in Israel. Sounds like a boy. Sounds like the fact that he has a daughter wouldn't take away the whole topic of Yibum, because a daughter is not going to be named for him and not going to carry on his name. And yet the Torah, the oral Torah, explaining the Torah, inseparable partnership, teaches us that Uvein Ein Lo means only if he had no offspring at all. How do we know Chamor could be any animal? Because we are taught in the oral law that it's Chamor Lav Dafka, not necessarily. How do we know that Chamor and Pidyon Peter Chamor means Ach Virak, just a donkey? Because we are taught that by the oral law. When day means 24 hours, we're taught that by the oral law. When day means daytime as opposed to nighttime, that's what we're taught. When Lo Tacharosh B'shoru V'chamor Yachtav included not just plowing with an ox and a donkey, but doing anything with two animals that are not compatible harnessed together, it was the oral Torah that is teaching us that this mitzvah is inclusive. In the very, very next verse, where it says, Lo tilbash sha'atnez, you shall not wear garments of sha'atnez, and explains what that means, tzemer ufishtim yachdav, wool and linen together, it means wool and only wool, and linen and only linen, and wearing and only wearing. You could make a tapestry to hang on your wall out of woven linen and wool. Not an Isur, not an Isur Durabanan, not a rabbinic decree, not a strict measure, not a custom, nothing. It's that question which has an all-important answer. The fact is, without the oral law, we don't know even the recipe for matzah. We don't know what anything in the Torah means without oral law. And therefore, the concept that there is a written word and an oral law is so fundamental to Judaism. You have to believe, trust, have confidence in that fact, that there is no way to properly understand the Torah without the inseparable partnership of oral law with the written word. So I need to add something very important to that. It's the Torah, which is the written word and the oral law. It is rabbinic law. It is time-honored custom. It is the weighing of strict measures, even if they're not required. That is the composite of halacha, Jewish law. It's not you follow the written word only. Ridiculous. You follow the written word and the oral law only, but no rabbinic law? Ridiculous. This is a package deal that Judaism is. It is a full-time, total commitment. And on that note, I will wish you a Shabbat Shalom. Hope that you got something good out of this show. L'hishtameah.